the headlines. At least 28 Palestinians, including 9 children, have been killed in 2 days of Israeli attacks on the besieged Gaza Strip. 2 Israelis are killed after a barrage of Palestinian retaliatory rockets struck Israel. And the EU's Brexit negotiator warns Britain to fully apply the terms of its exit from the bloc, particularly on fishing in Northern Ireland. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Israel has intensified its attacks on Gaza amid rising tensions between the two sides. Israeli jets pounded Gaza City as well as the town of Karara several times. The attacks left 2 people dead, bringing the Palestinian death toll from 2 days of airstrikes to 28. The victims include 1 woman and 9 children. On Tuesday, following an emergency meeting with military officials, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that his forces would increase the intensity and frequency of attacks. Earlier, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said that it conducted the biggest retaliatory attack against Israel. The group's military wing, Bassam Brigades, said it fired more than 40 rockets toward the cities of Ashdod and Ashkelon. It said the attacks were in response to Israel's airstrikes on Gaza's residential areas. According to the Israeli ambulance service chief, 2 people were killed in the strikes. The ongoing wave of violence broke out on Monday after Hamas issued an ultimatum demanding Israel remove its forces from the Al-Hamas compound. Ashraf Shannon is our correspondent joining us from Gaza City. Ashraf, we're looking at a particular site in the skyline of Gaza where somewhere has been hit because there's large plumes of black smoke billowing through the air. What has been hit?
Well, if I see that correctly, I think somewhere in northern Gaza near an Israeli fuel line or something in northern Gaza, because that picture in the skyline is not in Gaza City. It's all the way north of the enclave. It is possible that maybe a rocket that was fired from the Gaza Strip hit that Israeli oil reservoir in the north of the enclave, while Israel continues to pound the enclave since yesterday, and Palestinians are retaliating with scores of projectiles to the retaliation to the Israeli attacks that have claimed the lives of more than at least 28 Palestinians, including 10 children.
When we take a look at what's happening, do you still get the sense that this is a continuing military attack on the Gaza Strip from Israel?
Definitely. This is an all-out war. This is Israel launched 3 wars since 2008 on the Gaza Strip, and I believe this is the fourth one. And the statements coming out from the Israeli media, quoting Israeli military press, that Israel plans to launch more airstrikes against the Gaza Strip.
What have we heard from any of the resistance groups in terms of what types of plans they may have?
Well, the resistance factions in Gaza, including Hamas, Islamic Jihad, PFLP, and the Public Resistance Committees, have all maintained that they will continue to retaliate until the Israeli regime stops its attacks against Gaza and stop its aggression in Jerusalem al-Quds.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Ashraf Shannon there from Gaza City, giving us the latest. Well, tensions are simmering in Jerusalem al-Quds, where Israeli forces have attacked Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. The violence broke out on Friday, and since then, hundreds of Palestinians have been wounded. In response, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has followed through on its promise, and it has sent a barrage of rockets into Israel.
More attacks by Israeli forces against Palestinians in the occupied Jerusalem of Quds. On Monday, over 300 Palestinians were wounded after Israeli troops fired rubber bullets on them around the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Scores were detained by Israeli forces. The protests erupted after Israeli troops stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in an effort to force out the Palestinians. The violence around the mosque and the Old City were the worst since 2017, fueled by a years-long bid by Israeli settlers to take over Palestinian homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. The Israeli regime is also celebrating its 1967 occupation of Jerusalem al-Quds.
There are several facts here. One is that this is a process of, once again, of ethnic cleansing in broad daylight. It is a provocation, obvious provocation against Islam, and has appropriately been denounced by most Arab countries, including a couple of them who are overly anxious to normalize relations with Israel and hopefully will now reconsider what they've done.
Sheikh Ikrimah Sabri, the imam and preacher of Al-Aqsa Mosque, has condemned the attack, calling the raid a heinous crime that cannot be tolerated. Leader of the Palestinian National Initiative Party, Mustafa Barghouti, called the Israeli raid on Al-Aqsa Mosque compound a criminal act. Barghouti described the raid as a racist act by an apartheid regime.
Well, Israel is indisputably an apartheid state. It always has been from the outset, from 1948 on. It simply wasn't called that. The apartheid nature of Israel was confirmed in 1967 when it invaded the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem. Mustafa Barghouti is absolutely 100% right when he calls it a criminal act.
The military brigade of the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, also warned against the presence of Israeli forces in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The situation is so fluid, and resistance movements fired tens of rockets toward occupied Palestine Monday afternoon.
Well, attacks by Israeli forces against Palestinians in occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds have been brutal and extreme. So far, around 800 Palestinians have been reported to have been wounded since the Israeli violence broke out on Friday. This violence is the worst in Jerusalem al-Quds since 2017. It is fueled by the looming eviction of several Palestinian families from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood to make way for Israeli settlers.
The clashes in Al-Aqsa Mosque have drawn widespread condemnation from the international community. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres urged Israel to cease demolitions and evictions, saying Israeli authorities must exercise maximum restraint. The U.S. government, however, stopped short of condemning the Israeli aggression against Palestinians. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan instead conveyed serious concern to his Israeli counterpart about violent confrontations in Jerusalem al-Quds. Arab nations, including Syria, Iraq, and Qatar, also hit out at Israel over the Jerusalem violence. Some Arab countries, including those that last year normalized relations with Israel, condemned the Israeli aggression. Iran, Pakistan, and many other nations also slammed the attack. In Britain, Germany, Turkey, Jordan, and elsewhere, people took to the streets to condemn the Israeli regime's atrocities and voice solidarity with the Palestinian people. In some countries, like Oman, people gathered in front of the Israeli embassy to condemn the raids.
It's clear, I think, to the peoples of the world, even if it's not necessarily to political classes in the Occident, in the West, that Israel is the Israeli regime is a criminal entity, and what they're seeing practiced against the Palestinian people, Palestinian worshippers, which is really a reflection of a process that's gone on for far too long and backed by Western governments, specifically Washington and its allies. So there's no surprise in the fact that people everywhere in the world are outraged.
The Israeli desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque is nothing new. Israel has done similar acts in the past many times. Tel Aviv has been violating the rights of Palestinians with impunity since its installment in the region by its Western creators. The regime enjoys full support from the U.S. in particular.
The reason that Israel was created in the first place was that it was meant to be a foothold for British expansion into the region and to the control of oil and gas, natural gas resources in the region.
What is clear is the fact that the Israeli aggression against Palestinians cannot end through dialogue. Israel has defied calls to stop violating the rights of Palestinians for decades. Many factions in Palestine have also come to the conclusion that Israel can be pushed back only through resistance, and that any effort short of resistance will come to nothing given Washington's all-out support for the Israeli regime at the UN Security Council, the only world body that can issue a binding resolution against the regime.
South Africans have joined the chorus of denunciation against Israel over its violence in the occupied Palestinian territories. Hundreds showed up to join the Palestine Solidarity Campaign in Cape Town. They chanted anti-Israel slogans while marching toward Parliament. An organizer said that they are campaigning for Parliament to adopt an anti-Israel boycott, divestment, and sanctions bill. Pro-Palestinian rallies have also been held in the Tunisian capital. In Pakistan, people hit the streets of the port city of Karachi to express solidarity with the Palestinians and denounce the Israeli violence against them. On Monday, similar protests were held in several other countries, including Jordan, Turkey, Lebanon, and Morocco. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has dismissed U.S. claims about a recent incident involving the two countries' vessels in the Strait of Hormuz. The IRGC said its patrol boats, while acting within the framework of maritime regulations and maintaining their legal distance, issued a warning to seven U.S. vessels on Monday. Said the U.S. vessels were engaging in unprofessional conduct, including flying helicopters, firing flares, and taking aimless, unnecessary, and provocative shots. The IRGC said the U.S. vessels rectified the conduct following the warning and continued on their way. The Pentagon chief had earlier claimed U.S. naval forces fired warning shots after IRGC boats harassed an American Navy submarine and escort ships. Iran says the legitimate U.S. presence is a source of instability and insecurity in the region, including in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz. The European Union's Brexit negotiator has warned Britain to fully apply the terms of its departure from the bloc or risk losing credibility on the global stage. Michel Barnier said Britain is not doing its commitments on fishing and Northern Ireland. He urged London to respect the Brexit terms on those two crucial issues that were approved in the two agreements in 2019 and 20. The EU has already launched legal proceedings against Britain over a unilateral six-month delay to imposing customs controls on goods arriving in Northern Ireland from Britain. Tensions also flared last week over fishing, when French boats amassed at the Channel Island of Jersey, claiming that they were being denied licenses to fish off its shores despite a Brexit pledge of continued access. At least nine people are killed after gunmen opened fire at a high school in the southwest Russian city of Kazan. Authorities say the victims include seven children and two adults, including a teacher. Earlier, Russian media cited official sources as saying that 11 people had died. At least 20 were also injured during the attack. Police say they detained a 19-year-old suspect 1 hour after the deadly incidents. There were also reports of explosions at the school. President Vladimir Putin has expressed his deep condolences to the families of the victims and has called for a review of the country's gun control laws. School shootings are rare in Russia due to normally tight security in educational institutions and the difficulty in possessing firearms legally. Iran has reported more coronavirus infections and related deaths despite strict measures remained in place to curb the pandemic. The health ministry said 307 people succumbed to the disease in a span of 24 hours, pushing the overall death tally to more than 75,500. Authorities have also logged over 18,000 new infections, taking the overall caseload to nearly 2.7 million. The Iranian government imposed coronavirus restrictions last month, following a steep rise in deaths and infections. Health experts blamed the UK variant for the sharp rise. Popular tradition in Iran is to cook traditional food and give away to other people on different occasions. Some people make a vow with God, prepare foods, and donate, among others. Custom is mostly observed to feed those who are needy. Humanity has more.
On different occasions, especially during the holy month of Ramadan or on the martyrdom anniversary of Shia Imams, Iranians make a vow with their God to do something for charity. Hence, if their needs are met, they donate votive offerings as a public service. Type of food and its amount depends to the maker of the vow, who may be a rich person from the middle class or even from the poor. The popular places to fulfill the vows are mosques and the shrines of Shia Imams. The shrine of the 8th Shia Imam in the northeastern city of Mashhad is very famous for distributing food among pilgrims and the needy.
Every day, 20,000 dishes a meal are cooked to feed the pilgrims and others. Part of it is distributed among the poor and the suburbs. The funds to prepare these meals are provided by the shrine management and charity workers. We have also been distributing a basket of essential groceries among people across the country, too.
Officials told us that most of the people who help in cooking and preparing the votive food are khadem or servant. It means they do not get wages. These people work to fulfill their own vows, which are to give free service to the pilgrims.
Every day, 100 men and 100 women work here without getting salaries. They work just for the sake of their love for Imam Reza. Once a week, they come here to help us. It means that these 100 people who are working now would return next week. Tomorrow, another group will join us.
Almost 20,000 packs of iftar meal are also prepared and distributed among people every day at Imam Reza's shrine. Some 30,000 servings are also cooked outside the shrine by charity organizations in collaboration with Imam Reza's shrine management. A very nice tradition in Iran during the holy month of Ramadan is Nazri or Vodi food. People make food and distribute it among others for free. The reason for that is that they have a vow with their God to feed other people. Human Abadi, the holy city of Mashhad.
And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
America's security state has become so much corrupted under presidents of both parties, says Andrew P. Napolitano, author, in an article published under the heading More U.S. Government Spying and Lying. Stay tuned for more. Recently, the U.S. federal government's unconstitutional spying on ordinary Americans was exposed. One of these revelations was made by a federal judge in Washington, D.C., who wrote that the FBI is still using warrantless spying in criminal cases notwithstanding the Constitution and federal laws. The other revelation was a surprise even to those of Americans who monitor these things. The United States Postal Service acknowledged that it has been spying on Americans. Here is a backstory. The modern American security state, the parts of the federal government that spy on Americans and do not change on account of elections, received an enormous shot in the arm in 1978 when Congress enacted the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. That naively misguided and profoundly unconstitutional law was sold to Congress as a way to control the security state's spying in the aftermath of Watergate. Watergate had revealed that President Richard Nixon used the FBI and the CIA to spy on real and imagined domestic political adversaries. FISA set up a secret court that authorized domestic spying by issuing warrants not based on probable cause of crime, as the Constitution requires, but on probable cause of communicating with foreign agents. Never mind that communications about non-criminal matters are protected speech. The FISA court issued tens of thousands of these warrants. As the security state's appetite for spying grew more voracious, its agents and lawyers persuaded the FISA court to lower the bar for issuing a surveillance warrant from communicating with a foreign agent to communicating with a foreign person, and to expand the scope of those warrants to include Americans who have communicated with other Americans who have communicated with foreign people. Jealous of the ease with which America's spies can obtain warrants from the FISA court, the FBI persuaded its friends on Capitol Hill to enact legislation that gives the FBI a peek at data the security state gathers if it meets certain standards to see if any of it pertains to criminal matters. Each one of these FBI peeks at raw intelligence data is known as a share. All of this was done in utter disregard of the Fourth Amendment's requirements that no search warrants shall be issued without showing under oath probable cause of crime, and that all warrants shall specifically describe the place to be searched and the person or thing to be seized. If an FBI agent sees evidence of a non-national security crime on one of the shares, the agent will try to use it in a criminal prosecution, even though he required in it the violation of the Fourth Amendment. If federal prosecutors want to introduce evidence from the share at trial, they need to find another source for it, as no judge will admit raw intelligence data obtained without a warrant in a criminal case. After 9/11, President George W. Bush ordered the National Security Agency, the 60,000-person-strong branch of the military that quarterbacks domestic spying, to capture every keystroke on every computer and the contents of every phone call in America. All presidents since Bush, even President Donald Trump, who was personally victimized by this spying, have continued the practice of universal, suspicionless, warrantless spying. The NSA sharing data with the FBI is deeply troubling because it violates both the Fourth Amendment and the federal law. The intentional use of FISA to obtain data about an American for non-national security-related criminal activity is itself a criminal act, as it constitutes a planned and direct violation of the Fourth Amendment by the electronic means, otherwise known as hacking. Really? Recently, the chief judge of the FISA court revealed that for 2019, the FBI reported just one instance of sharing, even though Department of Justice auditors found 91 instances. And that matter is far lower than the true number of shares since, inexplicably, the DOJ counts all shares performed by one agent as one share, even though the agent may have accessed the data of more than one American. In August 2019, one FBI agent accessed the raw intelligence data of 16,000 Americans in order to find criminal evidence about seven of them. The FBI reported that as one share. Also recently, the USPS revealed that its postal inspectors have been monitoring social media at random, looking for troublemakers. Since social media is publicly posted, people can read it at will. But the Fourth Amendment requires that the government have articulate suspicion about the person whose social media is being surveilled before it begins its surveillance, even surveillance of publicly available materials. This is to prevent phishing expeditions. What articulable suspicions did the Postal Service have before its police began their surveillance? What conceivable threat to the postal mails is manifested in texts and emails other than that the latter are infinitely faster and profoundly more efficient? None. All this shows just how corrupted America's security state has become under presence of both parties, from counting 16,000 as if it were one, to hacking the texts and emails of people without articulable suspicion or probable cause, to orchestrating end runs around the Fourth Amendment, to lying to federal judges about all this. We see the tactics of the East German Stasi that has been reborn on this side of the Atlantic. Of what value is the constitutional guarantee of privacy if those Americans have hired to protect it are themselves undermining it?
سبحان الله والحمد لله لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر لا إله إلا الله.
Let's listen to the famous reciters of the Holy Quran in the month of Allah.
سبحان الله
Brother Muhammad Reza Birya, only in IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of the Month of Allah. We're going to be talking about famous reciters of the Quran and the world of Islam. Today, we'll be talking about Brother Muhammad Javad Hosseini, Sayyid Muhammad Javad Hosseini. He is a very famous reciter right now, not only in Iran, but in the whole world. And you can probably watch his videos on YouTube. If you search Muhammad Javad Hosseini, you'll notice that there are a lot of videos of him on the internet and on YouTube. This reciter was born in 1983 in a city close to Mashhad, where the shrine of Imam Ridha is located. He started learning Quran at the age of 11, and his teacher was his brother, Mustafa Hosseini. He started learning the Quran at an early age when he was 11 years old, and his teacher was his brother, Sayyid Hassan Hosseini. Later, in order to learn the other rules of recitation, such as tajweed, maqamat, and waqf wal-ibtida, he became the student of great masters of Quran, such as Mustafa Javidi and Mr. Sadat Fatimi. Brother Sayyid Muhammad Javad Hosseini participated in the Quran competition held in Iran in the year 2009, and he placed first. He won the competition. And this was the very first time that he participated in an international competition. This recitation that we're about to listen to is a recitation which was performed in Madinatul Sadr of Baghdad, which is a district in the city of Baghdad in Iraq. And it's interesting that in this recitation, one of the people in the audience asked Brother Muhammad Javad Hosseini to recite the verses 89 to 90 of Surah Al-Anbiya in Maqam Kurd. He smiled, and then he used Maqam Kurd in this recitation that we're about to listen to. And it's very interesting that someone from the audience requests the reciter to use such and such Maqam. And we see this in the recitation performed by Brother Muhammad Javad Hosseini. He uses Maqam Kurd in the recitation that we're about to listen to right now, which is Suratul Anbiya, verses 89 to 90, by Sayyid Muhammad Javad Hosseini. Let's enjoy this recitation.
And mention Zechariah when he called to his Lord, "My Lord, do not leave me alone with no heir, while you are the best of inheritors." So we responded to him, and we gave to him John, and amended for him his wife. Indeed, they used to hasten to good deeds and supplicate us in hope and fear, and they were to us humbly submissive.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
The U.S. War Party is among the greatest losers. Consider Afghanistan, says Doug Bando, author, in an article published under the heading, Washington War Party creates another organization to promote endless wars. Stay tuned for more. After 20 years of U.S. death and destruction in Afghanistan, the U.S. administration ordered a withdrawal. Most Americans backed the decision to stop at least one endless war. But the bipartisan war party in Washington is horrified. The neocons already dominate Washington. Republican Party, think tanks, and media such as the Wall Street Journal. Neocon influence also reaches well into the Democratic Party. What was Hillary Clinton other than a neocon in liberal drag? Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Bob Menendez appears to be as committed to promiscuous intervention as any Republican. Samantha Power famously expressed irritation that popular anger over the Iraq disaster, imagine that, prevented war-happy policymakers like her from launching bloody new foreign crusades. So many countries to bomb, so little time. But in the neocons' view, even this dominance isn't nearly enough. When even one non-interventionist is on the loose in Washington, they believe they must act decisively. More important, Donald Trump is still active, enjoying the loyalty of the seriously deranged GOP base. He was rarely consistent or coherent. His hawkish staffers easily manipulated him to stay in, and often even escalate the conflicts that he inherited. However, unlike the neocons, he really didn't like war. The last president who did not embark on at least one new misadventure and needlessly sacrifice American lives was Jimmy Carter. Trump's surprisingly peaceful policy left the war lobby confused, distraught, and angry, even though Trump routinely hired its members. The ultimate question is leadership to do what? The U.S. led in Iraq. The result? Destruction of a country, sectarian war, mass civilian casualties, creation of multiple insurgent terrorist groups, slaughter of minority religious communities was a humanitarian and a strategic disaster. The U.S. led for 2 decades in Afghanistan for no good reason, attempting to create a strong central government and Western-style democracy where none had previously existed. The U.S. claimed to lead in Yemen, promising to limit civilian casualties while providing the self-aggrandizing Saudi royals with everything necessary to wreak death and destruction upon the Yemeni people. The U.S. spent decades leading against Iran, helping to overthrow a democratically elected government, aiding a neighboring dictatorship's aggressive war against Tehran that killed 1 million-plus people, shooting down an Iranian airliner, and many other examples of U.S. terror against Iran. Today, the neocons and the rest of the war party define leadership as defending rich allies, rebuilding failed states, creating enemies faster than they can be killed, starving peoples to hurt their leaders, supporting aggressive war in the name of humanity, and intervening everywhere against everyone for anything. No wonder even America's friends have grown leery of its leadership. Washington now even acts against longtime allies. Those which refuse to accept U.S. leadership and enforce America's will are punished as enemies. To start, every sanction is secondary as the war lobby abuses America's financial dominance to conscript others in Washington's endless economic crusades. Worse, supposed friends become official targets. For instance, Washington punished Germany for building a natural gas pipeline to Russia because the U.S. said doing so is not in Berlin's interest. Many Germans suspect that Washington's feigned solicitude is primarily a ploy to force Europe to purchase more American natural gas. Hence, global leadership at its most cynical. No country poses a serious conventional threat to America. NATO is welfare for European states which can't be bothered to use their own resources, collectively 11 times the economic power and 4 times the population, to defend against Russia. Indeed, Moscow couldn't easily digest Georgia and Ukraine if it invaded them. Militarily, China threatens U.S. influence in East Asia, not the homeland. A huge difference. Even the worst neocon fantasies don't project Chinese invasion fleets advancing on Los Angeles and Seattle. In essence, Washington fears losing its ability to coerce China nearly 8,000 miles away, not defend America from Chinese aggression. The challenge posed by Beijing is principally other than military. In particular, the U.S. did not want Eurasia dominated by any one power, especially an adversary of America. American leadership requires Washington to do for others what they should be doing for themselves, such as providing for their defense. The U.S. is also one of the chief offenders against free trade. Even today, Washington routinely supports tyranny abroad. Egypt, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates are just 4 regimes that America backs almost unreservedly. Moreover, the U.S. is often callous and cruel. For instance, the now pervasive use of sanctions appears to be mostly a continuing attempt to signal virtue than achieve anything practical. Officials like former Ambassador Jim Jeffrey, who admitted misleading Trump to keep Americans entangled in the Syrian imbroglio, appear to get cruel pleasure from immiserating an entire population to turn it into a geopolitical quagmire for other states. Never mind the millions of innocent people who suffer along the way. So far, most sanctions have failed to achieve their purported policy ends. Indeed, the Trump administration's multiple maximum pressure crusades were a stunning debacle. Targeting individual malefactors proved emotionally satisfying, but had no practical impact. The only possible foreign conclusion was that Trump's sanctions policy was being implemented by fools, idiots, or both. He did a fine, if inadvertent, job of undermining American credibility worldwide. And then there are America's many wars. In Yemen, even the State Department warned that top U.S. officials risked being charged as accomplices to war crimes by aiding the vile Saudi dictatorship's aggressive war. Indeed, Yemeni civilians call it the Saudi-American War. In Libya, the Obama administration lied about humanitarian threats to win United Nations Security Council approval for what became a regime change operation on the cheap. Muammar Gaddafi was a dictator. but committed no civilian massacres, and his widely cited threats were directed against armed opponents, not civilians. The result of U.S. intervention was an added decade of civil war, including another battleground for Daesh. Most horrific was Iraq. Set aside the thousands of dead and tens of thousands of wounded Americans, victims of lies and manipulated intelligence. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, estimates begin at about 200,000 and range well above a million, were killed. Millions were displaced. Religious minorities were targeted, murdered, kidnapped, enslaved, raped, and driven from their homes. Al-Qaeda in Iraq was spawned, mutating into ISIS. The country was ravaged. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
People who limit the Quran to worshipping and personal matters haven't understood it. This is a part of a speech delivered on April 14, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, at the annual Ramadan Quranic meeting. The speech was delivered via video conference with the participation of a number of prominent Quranic reciters.
Those who confine the Quran and Islam to personal matters, acts of worship and other such issues, who invite people to sit in a corner and who tell them to put aside the Quran once they enter into society, do not have a correct understanding of the Quran. They are really not familiar with the Quran. One should say that they have not read the Quran. That is why they make such mistakes and such wrong judgments. They are really not familiar with the Quran. The Quran does not stand aside when it comes to political and social challenges, and it does not refrain from confronting falsehoods, the arrogant, the wasteful, and the oppressor. On the contrary, it has always stood up against them. If you are men of the Quran, thus the Quran should be present in the heart of your life. Therefore, the Quran has undertaken human guidance and assistance in all areas. There is no doubt about this. فيك الحب زاد عم العباد يا خير زاد رمضان يا شهر القرآن فيك أذوق حلاوة الإيمان لا لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان ليتك دوما قريب Despite the fact that the Quran is available to us, whether we can benefit from it is an important issue in itself. The Quran has provided us with the lesson and the guidance. But when can we benefit from it? In it is sure guidance without doubt for the muttaqeen. The Holy Quran, chapter 2, verse number 2. When we have piety, the Quranic guidance will be available to us in the real and true senses of the word. Of course, there are different terms in the Quran, but they all refer to one single concept. In this ayah, which is in the beginning of the Holy Quran, God says, Muttaqeen. In other ayah, God says, and guidance and glad tidings for those who believe. Chapter 2, verse 97. In another ayah, he says, a guide and a mercy to all who believe. Chapter 7, verse 52. And elsewhere he says, as a guide and glad tidings to Muslims. Chapter 16, verse 102. Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.